Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Row by Row Garden Show. We're coming at you live from Hoss Tools headquarters here in Norman Park, Georgia. I'm Travis.
And I'm Greg.
And we've got Big Jim in the production room there on the ones and twos. Everybody say hey to Big Jim. All right, so we have a really great show for you today. We're really excited about today's show. Today's show, we're going to talk about watermelons. We're going to talk about all different kinds of watermelons, seedless watermelons, seeded watermelons, varieties, all kind of watermelon.
Good watermelon.
Good watermelon.
Good watermelon.
And I thought we had to talk about you eating on the show.
Mm-hmm. I just can't help it.
You can't help it?
I can't help it.
Okay. Well, we'll let you slide just this one time.
Okay.
And then in addition to the watermelon talk, we're also going to talk a little bit. We'll have our show and tell session. Talk a little bit about what we're picking in the garden
now.
We'll have our tool of the week segment. And then we're going to answer some of your questions at the end of today's show. So let's dig right in and get into our show and tell segment. And this week, we want to show y'all some of the peppers we've been harvesting out of our garden. And a few different varieties we like to grow. And we change the rotation from 1 year to the next. And sometimes we keep some, sometimes we take some out. And the first one I want to tell you about here is this one's called Carmen, and this is the first year growing this one. This is a newer variety from Johnny's, and the market version of this, you're actually supposed to let it get red because it gets a really bright red color, and it's a what they call a sweet kind of roasting or frying pepper. They'll get a decent bit bigger than this, but I had just picked through all mine the other day, so this was the biggest I could find. A really good pepper, really good sweet pepper. And it's what they call a Corno di Toro type. Mm. And so that's a type of Italian pepper. And this one's called Carmen because it gets red. They've got another one Johnny's does called Escamillo, which gets yellow. But this is a really good sweet pepper that I've enjoyed growing this year. One of the most productive pepper varieties I've got planted this year.
My favorite two varieties are banana and poblano.
And there's your banana right there. These bananas are awesome to grill. We really like to stuff these with sausage, cream cheese, wrap them in bacon.
Ooh, good stuff.
That's really, really good stuff. So always got to grow a banana. Bananas, peppers, we grow every single year.
Yep.
And they'll get bigger than this too. This is just one I found yesterday. One that I've grown before, but not in the last few years, that I added back this year is called a Cubanelle. And these are more kind of blocky peppers. These are sweet. These are really good eating raw. Like you can dip them in ranch dressing, put them on a veggie tray, but you can also...
They're classified as a sweet pepper, right?
Yeah, sweet pepper here. And these make nice stuff in peppers too, because like I said, they're blocky. There's a lot of space inside of them to stuff. And then the last one we've got here that we're growing this year is called a Serrano, okay? These kind of look like a jalapeno, but they're a little more long and slender as opposed to kind of fat like a jalapeno will get. These are a little hotter than a jalapeno.
Yeah, I actually ate one the other day and it lit me up. Now, it wasn't a lingering heat, but it was heat, boom, and it was gone. It was good. But I'm not a big hot pepper eater. It kind of caught me off guard. But it did have some heat to it, but it left pretty quick.
Yeah, if you cut the membrane out of the middle and take the seeds out, I don't find they're that bad at all, even eating them raw in a taco or something. But
I must have got a hold of some seeds.
You must have got a hold of some seeds. But these are nice this year. And with hot peppers, jalapenos, serranos, anything like that, the level of heat on them has a lot to do with how much water they're given. And so if you have a dry year, you're not giving them a lot of water, you can expect them to be on the upper range of the heat level.
Yeah, and the longer they stay on the vine and mature, sometimes that heat level can change also.
Right. And if you give them, you got them on drip, give them plenty of water, they won't be near as bad. So keep that in consideration when you're growing your peppers. All right, and now let's get into our tool of the week. And our tool of the week this week is very appropriate because this is the time of the year when we're switching over from early spring crops maybe into some summer crops. A lot of crop turnover going on right now. And one of my favorite tools to use in this crop turnover process is this push-pull hoe. A lot of times, especially with things like onions, towards the end of that crop maturity, the weeds can get away from us a little bit. And we need to go in there and clean up that spot. And we don't always want to till those weeds in because we're going to add to that weed seed bank in the soil. So we'd like something we can go in, cut them off soil level, and clean up those areas and get them ready to plant something else.
Yeah, this actually is a USA-made tool, made in Pennsylvania. It's heat-treated, so it's a high-carbon steel. They heat-treat this thing, and it's got serrated edges on the front and the back side here that's sharp. Now, this is a little unique, and it's different than what you're probably used to using as a hoe. We think about hoeing, and we think about chopping. Well, this baby used it completely different. We call it a push-pull hoe because you lay it on flat on the ground, and you push and pull, and it cuts off those weeds right below the soil level there. And it's real handy for drip tape because you can weed on top of drip tape without getting into it and cutting it. It's one of the few tools that you can use to weed around with drip tape. Also, where my trunk line is, I like to kind of go underneath my trunk line, and I can weed up there at the head of my drip tape with that. It's an awesome tool. It's very few tools nowadays are made in the USA, but this one still is. It's one of our premier products. We sell lots of them, and there's a reason why, because it works really good.
Yeah, but so with the exception of our wheel hose, this is our most popular product, and during our busy season sell over 100 a week.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really popular. And if you'll notice right here, just to clarify for a few people, we powder coat these tools here just so they don't rust while they're sitting in our warehouse. Once you get and put this thing in the dirt here, you'll expose that sharpened edge and be there. So if you get one and you're thinking, well, this edge doesn't look very sharp, just once you put it in the dirt, wear that powder coat off.
Yeah, it actually gets sharper the more you use it.
That's right. That's right. I've had mine for about 5 years or so, and I don't think I've ever really sharpened it.
What we find is a lot of people order one, then their neighbor will come over and see it and use it, and then they order one for their in-laws or for their friends, whatever. So
yeah.
It's hard to order just one.
We had a lady right before Father's Day, I think, ordered 5 or 6 of them, sent them to all the dads or fathers in her life, and really good gift.
Makes a great gift.
Okay, so check out that push-pull hoe on our website.
Yep.
You'll be able to see that, and grab you one of those if you'd like. Now into the main segment this week, where we are talking about watermelons.
Watermelons are a very fun thing to grow in your garden. Now, if you're a beginner gardener, you may not want to try watermelons, but I mean, they're not that hard to grow, and they're fun because if you got kids, or if you're like me and you just flat love watermelon, I ate 3 yesterday. I love watermelons. So I grow watermelons in my garden every year, and I time to harvest them. I take them and put them underneath the tree, and I go out there and eat me 2 or 3 a day.
Yeah, watermelons are 91% water. That's why they call them watermelons. And they're really good for your kidneys because they kind of flush out your system, keep you from getting kidney stones. My wife even said when they were in college, they were getting ready to go a few weeks before spring break, they would all go on a watermelon diet. And it's evidently a very good way to lose a lot of weight in a short amount of time. But
I can also tell the difference in my attitude. If I go out and eat a couple of watermelons, I have a whole better attitude when I come back in than I do before. So if I get a little ticked off, I just go eat me a couple of watermelons, and it does a lot for my, I guess it's all the water, does a lot for my attitude.
Yeah, we need to make sure we don't run out of watermelons.
That's exactly right.
All right.
Let me show again, Trav. Well, let me show mine right here. Now, this is my crop this year, which I had some issues with. We had a lot of rain.
Mm-hmm.
And I got some disease in mine. Now, I always grow the Crimson Sweet. Now, this is one of the smaller ones, and they normally get bigger than this, but mine this year didn't get the size they normally do. The Crimson Sweets are a seeded variety, and they have a dark, rich meat in there. Now, there's several different varieties out there. The Crimson Sweet just happens to be the one that I like to grow, and this is the one that I grow every year. Like I said, this one's a little on the small side. Now, we had probably 7 to 8 inches within 7 or 8 days here a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I got disease in my watermelons, and I didn't make near the crop I normally did. So water, a lot of rainfall water, can have an effect on your watermelon crop.
Yeah, that's cool. That water is going to, that excess moisture is going to really allow those fungal spores to get in there and start germinating, and you're going to have some powdery mildew, some downy mildew problems.
Anthracnose.
Yeah. So with those diseases in growing watermelons, just like squash, any other type of cucurbit, crop rotation, really, really important.
It is. It's more important with watermelons than it is most any other thing you grow. Now, watermelons don't have much insect problems. They don't have much insect pressure, so you ain't got a lot to worry about there. But they do have a lot of disease problems. A lot of these newer varieties are bred where they're more disease resistant. But crop rotation and actually growing watermelons on what we call new ground that hadn't been gardened or farmed in a number of years is a good route to go, because you don't have near the pressure there.
Yeah, our buddy Bruce Frazier over at Dixondale Farms, in addition to their onion plant operation, they also grow a lot of cantaloupes. And they actually have a 6-year fallow ground program. So they rotate their cantaloupe plots around, and they only grow on a plot every 6 years and let it go completely fallow to reduce that pressure.
Right. So across from our office here, there is a large farm over there.
Yeah.
And they are growing watermelons commercially over there. You know, and a lot of people may not know how watermelons are grown commercially, so we wanted to show them how they're grown, because they're grown totally different commercially than they are for the backyard gardener. Now, for the backyard gardener, it's nearly impossible to grow some of the seedless varieties. So we always stick to some of the old heirloom seeded varieties, and I say heirloom loosely because the Crimson that I grew actually was released in 65, which doesn't make it an heirloom. But some of the older open pollinated varieties are easier to grow for the home garden. When you get in some of these seedless ones that you see in the grocery store, it's a whole different ball game.
Right. So we went over there, took some footage yesterday, and wanted to kind of, we'll explain what all this stuff means. But Jimmy, go ahead and roll that clip from yesterday across the street with our watermelons there.
Now, what you'll see here, is, which is kind of weird to me, but the row spacing in between the rows is 9 feet, which is a lot. But they do that for a reason, because these hybrid varieties produce so much. And plus, they have to have pollinators in there. So you've got your regular watermelons, and I believe this variety here is called, Fantasia? Anyway, it's a hybrid variety that's seedless. And then every third row, they plant what they call a pollinator.
Right.
And then inside the row, every third or fourth plant is a pollinator. So there's two different type of pollinators that you see there that are planted in with these seedless varieties, because I'm assuming they don't get enough pollen.
Well, I'll explain that in just a minute. But across the street, there are two types of pollinators there that you can tell, because they look very much different than the seedless varieties that they're growing. One of them is really small. One of them looks more like a jubilee and elongated.
So when the harvesting crews are in there, they know not to pick these because they look totally different.
Right, right. Now, in some situations, I've read where people will, the pollinators are actually harvestable varieties. But I think in that commercial situation, they're not harvesting the pollinators. So if we got a seedless watermelon, how do we get a crop of watermelons that are seedless if we don't have any seeds?
Good point.
Okay, so let's dig into that a little bit. First, let's talk a little bit about chromosomes, because chromosomes are the very important reason why we can get a seedless watermelon. So, in biological terms, when we talk about chromosomes, we use this variable N. And N is the number of copies of chromosomes that a cell has. And we can see variations in those numbers of copies of chromosomes. So haploid cells, which are our gametes, that's our sperm and egg cells, they only have one copy of the chromosomes. That's because when the sperm and the egg fuse, you end up with two copies, which is what normal cells have. So diploid cells, which are all the other cells in your body that are not gametes, all have two copies of each chromosome. So our skin cells, the watermelon cells, your regular watermelon, your seeded watermelon, that crimson sweet, is going to be what we call a diploid seed. And then we can have a triploid seed, okay? And we can even have a tetraploid seed. So how do we get to that seedless watermelon. So what they actually do is they take a regular watermelon seed, a diploid seed, and they treat it with this chemical here called colchicine. And what the colchicine does is it takes that diploid seed and it interferes with the cell division. So when the cells multiply and divide, the genetic material doesn't separate. You end up with a tetraploid seed. So that's what you're actually planting when you're planting a seedless watermelon seed. You're planting a seed that's double the number of chromosomes or genetic information than a normal watermelon does. The problem with that tetraploid seed is watermelons, you know, they produce male and female flowers. The male flower, the bee pollinates the female flower by getting the pollen from the male flower, transferring that to the female flower. And they say it takes about 1,000 grains of pollen to pollinate one female watermelon flower, which usually takes about 8 to 9 trips for a bee. Anyway, so on these tetraploid plants, like it's planted out there, it'll produce a female flower, but the male flower has little to no pollen on it. And so if it was just planted by itself, that female flower would never become pollinated because there's no pollen out there. There comes in the importance of the pollinator species. So the pollinator species are out there to provide that pollen in the form of those male flowers so they can fertilize these tetraploid plants. Okay, when you mix a diploid, which would be the pollinators, with the tetraploid, we get a triploid.
Woo! A lot of ploids there.
A lot of ploids. And triploids are sterile, which means they don't make any seeds. So that's how we get a seedless watermelon.
So we see we got our lesson there on seedless watermelons, and we see it gets kind of complicated.
Very complicated.
So for the home gardener, I just don't think it's feasible to be growing the seedless varieties. And I'll tell you one reason why. Them seeds are absolutely outrageous. If you was going to buy 10 or 15 seeds and order them, they could easily cost you $1.50 to $1.75 a piece. Now, if you got up and you ordered several thousand of them, you could get it down to a quarter a piece. But a quarter a piece for the seed is outrageous.
Yeah, and I've also read there's a lot of different strategies out there of how you arrange those pollinators. Excuse me. So, and some places recommend every third plant being a pollinator. Some do it, like you said, across the street, where every third row is a pollinator. There's a lot of research.
Well, they got two different kind of pollinators over there.
Right. So, and so there's a lot of different thoughts out there on how to arrange those pollinators. And also with the planting, with their help out there, they have to be aware and make sure they plant those pollinators equally spaced out there. And so I saw where some people were actually in their transplant trays making every third plant the pollinator, so they wasn't grabbing two from the seedless, one from the pollinator when they're transplanting.
Right. So if you do want to grow watermelons in your garden, most of the time they're in the 85 to 90 day range to maturity. So they're not an extra long crop and they're fairly easy to grow. Disease pressure, as I mentioned, is your biggest issue there. As far as variety goes, let's talk about what would be good varieties to grow for the home gardener there. And I'm going to start out with the Crimson that I like to grow, which is Crimson Sweet. There's also one called the Jubilee, which is a longer type watermelon.
Yeah, that's more of your older traditional style watermelons that you
right.
You don't see them as much anymore, but they were the popular ones for a long time.
Yep, and you've got the Charleston Gray, which was grown a lot back in the 70s. And they were, if you went in the grocery store much time, that's what you would see would be a Charleston Gray, mm-hmm. especially up north.
And that's the one, the lighter.
Lighter color, and they was a little bit smaller. Now, one of the older varieties that I can remember the furthest back is called Moon and Stars. Now, that's an old variety that my grandfather grew, and that's a great one to grow in the garden, too. Now, Baker Creek has got one called Orange Glow that I grew a few years ago. And if you want to do something a little bit different, this is a great variety. And it's not really considered a yellow watermelon, but it's considered more of an orange meat. And it's very tasty, very good, very easy to grow. The only downside to it is the wall is real thin, so it can't take a lot of handling. It wouldn't work good for a market farmer because it bruises real easy, but it is a great watermelon to grow and it's a little different. It tastes really well.
Yeah, Yeah, the orange glow is one of those things, kind of like that Brandywine tomato we talked about last week. It just looks like it tastes better. I'm not sure you could tell the difference, but that orange color really just makes your mouth water.
Yeah, it's, they're good. So if you're not growing watermelons and you want to think about it, it's definitely a fun crop to grow. The biggest thing I can tell you is grow them on new ground or ground that hadn't been grown any type of watermelons, cantaloupes, or anything like that in the last few years.
Use drip irrigation.
Use drip irrigation. Drip irrigation is very important.
Yeah, you want to reduce that moisture on those leaves and plants, and then harvest at the right time.
Yeah, and the way, there's two different ways you can tell how to harvest, and we did a video on this a couple of years ago. You can look at the curlicue, or you can also look at the bottom side of the watermelon, what we call the belly, and you want that belly nice and cream colored.
Yeah.
So that's the two different ways they kind of tell in the field when they're ready to harvest.
Yeah, the whole thumping deal, all that. Look at that curlicue, and you can check out that video as well, nice video telling you how to tell when they're ripe. And we live probably an hour or a little over from the watermelon capital of the world in Cordele, Georgia.
Yep.
And towards the end of June, early July, they have a watermelon festival over there. And there's a famous country song written about that.
The
Watermelon Crawl, that's right. So a lot of watermelons being grown around here. I'm sure there's always some arguments between cities on who was actually the watermelon capital of the world. But I think Cordele was one of the first ones that deemed that name.
Well, the 4th of July is a huge market for watermelons, and our area is conducive to grow watermelons, to have them coming off for that time. So that's one reason we have a really good market for our watermelons. That's the reason a lot of them are grown commercially. We got a good climate, we got good soil for watermelon.
Right. And watermelons is kind of like corn. You just got a small window there where you just got to enjoy them, and once they're gone, they're gone.
Yep.
You buy imported watermelons, they're just not as good as the ones grown around here.
Yep.
All right, so I hope you guys enjoyed that talk about watermelon, learned a thing or two. Now let's get into some of our questions from our comments last week and from previous weeks. And if we answer your question on air, we'll give you one of these fancy
highly coveted
people just been knocking at the door trying to get these nice Hoss koozies right here. So put your questions in the comments, and if we answer them, we'll send you one of those. If we do answer your question, just send us an email to cusserve@hosstools.com with your address, and we'll get that koozie on the way to you. All right, so the first question this week is from, a channel on YouTube called Homemade Homestead, and they want to know, what is the best soil type for purple hull peas?
Well, my thoughts on that would be sandy loam soils, and I'll tell you the reason why. Purple hull peas are a legume, so they don't take a lot of fertility or a lot of high nitrogen. So they do like a really warm climate, and a well-drained soil such as a sandy loam soil, I think, is ideal for growing purple hull peas. Now, one of the biggest problems we have down here is insect pressure.
Yeah, so purple hull pea, a lot of our friends in the north, they don't grow, we call them field peas around here. There are several different varieties, purple hulls, zippers, all that. Much different than your English peas.
Yeah.
So the field pea, you'll see, sometimes hear them called southern peas or cow peas. Really popular as a staple down here. But in the last 5 years or so, the disease pressure has gotten so bad that it's almost impossible to grow them without the peas just being stung up.
Well, that's an insect. It's called pea curcuma, and it has become terrible in our area. A lot of people don't even grow them anymore. You get lucky every now and then can grow a crop that's not stung up very bad, but they actually sting that pod there and make a little dark spot on them, and they're not marketable after that. So we don't see a lot of peas growing in our area anymore on kind of that. But if I was going to grow them, I think a sandy loam soil and a good southern climate would be ideal for them.
Yeah, like you said, even the commercial guys have really quit growing them. Personally, I don't mind eating them myself if they're a little stung up, but
they actually lay an egg in there, so most people don't want to eat them if they're stung up.
Yeah, but I can't really tell a huge taste difference, but a lot of people won't eat them that way, and you definitely can't sell them at a store that way, so it kind of does a number on the peas. So we some of our friends on the Row by Row page had some peas growing, and I was quite envious because I wish we could still grow them.
Oh, yeah, they're delicious.
All right. And then our second question this week is from Wrestler Mama, not wrestler like WWE,
no.
But Wrestler Mama asks, any tips for gardening on a hill? She said where she lives in West Virginia, there's not that much flat land.
They ain't nothing but hills in West Virginia. But where we live is really flat, so we don't have a lot of experience with growing hills. But now, one thing I would think would be very beneficial from growing on hills would be drip irrigation, because you don't have a lot of erosion problems with that drip irrigation. So I think drip would be a great thing to use on a hillside where you had a garden, because you wouldn't have to worry with overhead irrigation and erosion problems.
That, and you can also use some techniques. You want to plant alongside the hill.
Instead of up and down.
You don't want to plant up and down the hill. So plant alongside the hill. And there's some things you can do as far as engineering the land a little bit to hold the water better. You can make some terraces in there. Kind of have beds going alongside the hill. And then have some terraces in there. So that water will hold. So it's not just flushing down the hill and washing out your garden. And you get some water retention there on that hill.
Right.
You want to, like I said, reduce that runoff and use the most out of your water. But as long as you plant them that way, I think drip irrigation would also be very effective.
Yep, I think so too.
All right, guys. Well, that is going to do it for this week's show. Be sure to catch us next week. And, Jimmy, why don't you send us out on some watermelon crawl?